I'm going to ask each of you what you think of the other statements, what was said, what was not said.
I want to say I found Saeed's talk very engaging, very interesting. Gave me a sense of her worldview and where she's coming from. But what I heard over and over again was wishful thinking. Your position is, well, I think we ought to have standards. I think Muslims should not impose their faith on us. I think people ought to be, there ought to be moderate mosques. And I think people should not be under the power of jihadist Islam. But these were all your personal opinions about the way things, the way you would like things to be. In reality, that's not the way it is. So, in a sense,
Why are we talking about secularism? Because the points you raised were not about Islam. If I say people should not, ought to, this or that, it wasn't based on the list I'm talking about secularism and separation of church and state.
But I thought the topic here is Islam and the way Islam is a moderate form of Islam that will not be dangerous to non-Muslims. I thought that was your theme.
Right. And I discussed the fact that Muslims are moderate because they, in most communities, practice it as a personal faith, but they don't have a church, quote-unquote, among them. And so the odd part has to do with organizing the moderation into a force that actually can then found their lifestyle that already exists in a way that is truly defended by a valid interpretation of faith.
Yes, and what you're talking about is what I'm sure everybody here is, Mary Robert Spencer.
But it's not just that
there never, despite over the centuries, innumerable repetitions of efforts to create an institutionalized form of the kind of moderate Islam that society is talking about. It has never succeeded.
That's not true. How about Sufism? How about Alevism? How about Ismailism? These are all forms of Islam that are not political, that are not anti another group, that do not have a militant faith to them.
Well,
the majority of South Asian Muslims, which is over 300 million, are moderate because the Arab version of Islam that took root in South Asia became influenced by Sufism.
Is Pakistan part of South Asia?
Yes, it is.
Are you saying most of Pakistan is moderate Muslim?
Not now because of the Saudi madrasas that have taken over since the 80s. But before then, when pre-Pakistan was part of South Asia, there was a moderate Islam. There were Muslims there.
So
Afghanistan too.
When Islam took over
the Mughal Empire,
the Mughal Empire was later. Before, when Islam was taking over much of the Indian continent.
Well, that's just it. Before and later, you have different empires. The Ghaznavids took over Lahore in like 1100. So it just depends what you're talking about. That's why I don't like engaging in historical debates about centuries ago, because it has nothing to do with what Muslims actually think today. Muslims fought each other for power. Safavids versus, you know, the Umayyads or whatever. They were all fighting each other. Three out of the four Khalifas were murdered. You're not talking about a unity and one understanding of Islam ever.
Oh, but that's right.
The same argument used to be made today. And if you're not believing this one version as militant, you're not really Muslim.
But then why are there no institutionalized forms of the type of Islam that you described?
There are. Sufism.
Sufism is not mainstream.
And the majority of Muslims that are
Sufism
moderate...
Sufism is not relevant to the great vast body of Islam.
I'm sorry.
But you didn't...
I'm jumping around.
Yeah, you said there's nothing organized. Well, there is something organized. They're not mainstream. They're small, but they're organized. They've been organized for a long time.
But that's not an alternative for the Muslims you're talking about. They're not going to become Sufis, the Muslims you're talking about.
The point I'm trying to make is that
why are they
speaking
out?
What is it? Come to the Sheikh Kalbani in the DC area, who's, I guess, the most prominent Sufi Sheikh in the United States. But the problem is with Sunni Islam, which, yes, to your point, is probably about 80% of Islam. I'll give you that. The Sunni the throng, which is the majority, is the type that is moderated in South Asia, at least by the Sufism and the influence of Hinduism or whatever else, but with Wahhabism and the Salafi movement from Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood that has all their money from Saudi Arabia, their interpretation based on Sayyid Qutb's writing in the 1900s, Hassan al-Banna's writing, which was militant, anti-colonial, anti-Jewish because of Israel, that is the stuff that's being propagated with their versions of the Quran, their interpretation of the Hadith. When I was growing up, or even in Pakistan, my sister-in-law was growing up, she said she wanted to read the Quran in English. Or Urdu rather, in Pakistan, and she went and got a Quran, and it was an interpretation with the commentaries on the side by Sayyid Qutb, who's one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood. Her mother told her not to read it and threw it out. So it depends on the family you're coming from. It depends on understanding that any Quran isn't all the Qurans. I'm not minimizing or marginalizing the fact that jihad is the biggest, most common vocab word of Muslims these days because of the militancy that's grown since the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood and all this anti-American, anti-Israeli movement since World War I. But
and they intimidate the moderates.
Sorry?
That's the point that we're missing here. They intimidate them.
The moderates have made the mistake.
There's a young man at Yale who spoke out against the cleric who said that we should have death for apostates. There's nothing wrong with that. And then he had his name withdrawn because he was afraid of getting in trouble. Now, that is the problem.
Yeah.
There's intimidation. What happened with the cartoons?
One quick thing I want to say is it's not like every jihad every mosque from day one has been espousing jihad to its congregation. My mom didn't grow up hearing jihad every single day. When I went to the mosque every year up until college, the mom never talked about jihad. But the point is, there is an anti-Americanism that with the Islamist books and Sayyid Qutb type writing or Imam Siraj Wajah from Brooklyn, they are the ones that are pushing this interpretation, and then there are now, ever since probably the 80s, I don't know if Steve Emerson knows, even if it's prior to the 80s, that with those Muslim Brotherhood influenced imams, they are the ones that are coming into the United States the way they have been talking in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Middle East, specifically giving sermons that are anti-American, anti-Israeli, espousing jihad, getting recruits. That never happened when I was growing up, at least in the mosque I went to. But yeah, is it happening in most mosques? Apparently it is.
Let me respond to a couple of points.
Yeah.
You're speaking of sort of waves of different types of Islam succeeding each other in different countries at different times over the centuries. But what you have is the recurrence of the extreme form of Islam. So you have the early centuries of the conquest and the subjugation.
Conquest was not extreme in an imperial age, it was the norm. In the modern nation-state age after World War I, it is extreme to want to be an empire. That's a fact.
You have the continual destruction of the ancient Christian and Jewish civilization of
the Bible was used to justify the civil war on both sides.
I'm sorry?
The Bible is used to justify the civil war on both sides.
And which civil war are you talking about?
The American Civil War.
What does that have to do with
it? It has to do with the fact that religion can be used for any purpose depending on whose hands it is in.
I don't see the relevance of the point. We're talking about the nature of Islam.
My point is that example is the fact that slavery was justified by faith by some people in the United States versus in that same time period, people used the same book, the Bible.
This is completely wrong. This is completely wrong because Christianity does not mandate any particular political system. Christianity is about the kingdom of God. It's about salvation. The New Testament is not a formula. Christianity does not mandate any particular social form. So you had Christianity was compatible with the Roman Empire. It was compatible with the early Dark Ages. It was compatible with the High Middle Ages. It's compatible with modern democracy. So Christianity is a transcendent religion which takes different forms in relation to the culture in which it finds itself. Islam is entirely different. Islam mandates a particular political system. and it mandates that system throughout the ages. So this thing that Ms. Ida said is not correct. Now I have a question.
Can I carry up?
Okay, go ahead.
That's completely false. The Pope, the Vatican Church, did not choose to retreat. Martin Luther and the Reformation didn't happen because the Pope joined him. It was a fight in Christian theology to change.
Well, people were committed to different views.
But
like
you're contradicting yourself by agreeing with me right now. Christianity is one thing, or it is not one thing, or it is an idea that has certain principles that evolved over time, just like any other philosophy or faith. Islam is the same thing. Right now, it can be the worst thing on the planet, because that in whose hands it is in control are the only people with the money and the interpretation to keep it going in a way that is resuscitating the jihadi militant imperial version of Islam.
Where is there an Islam that's in power in any country in the world where the leading imams will say that an apostate, it's not true that an apostate must die?
But that's two different points. You're talking about Islam versus the people interpreting it again. You don't have to be in power to have an opinion. If the majority of Muslims are moderate, and just because they don't have, which is the whole point that I'm saying, that for moderate Muslims to matter, they need to have an imam and a mosque behind their position to grow the point. It'll take time, and it won't happen.
How long will it take?
Okay, that's
too long.
No, this is a key question. Please don't let this
right,
go
back. But take 5 minutes to see what I want to direct this
over.
How long will this reformation or this moderation of Islam take, by your best hopes?
Decades.
In the meantime, the jihadists and the radicals are the dominant force within Islam. So what should the countries of the West do for the next, say, 50 years?
Which was my whole point of my talk, which was understanding what your standards are and rising to the level of maintaining those standards. So, which has to do with not even...
But the Muslims don't accept those standards.
Then they can leave. That's the whole
they're
point.
They're not leaving. Okay, they're not going to leave on their own.
Could I?
Okay.
I'm glad you two are moving in this direction, because that's what I wanted to direct you towards. So let me just say that, so it'll be right out there. I'd like you to focus on what you think of a paradigm in which you can consider that there are many different ways to practice Islam, and there's also a very urgent situation to deal with right now with people who want to do us harm one way or another, through warfare, through bombs, whatever. So keeping that in mind, that the situation is complex and it's also very direct, what would each of you do?
Well, I can say right away, Sabna does not offer anything to protect us from the actual threat. She wants us to go on talking, and eventually Muslims over, say, 50 years will be converted to a moderate Islam. Meanwhile, the danger is growing and taking us over.
You have misconstrued everything I just said. You asked me, will Islam change? And then I said a couple of decades. Now you misconstrued my statement by saying, I said it'll take a couple of decades for Muslims to be different in the United States. Those are two different facts, what we can do about Muslims in the United States. Those are two different points. My whole talk focused on the fact that Muslims or Islam to have an organized faith that's more moderate or liberal will take time. So in the meantime, what we can do that's proactive, that's top down, that's not waiting for them to change, is to go back and take a step and remind ourselves of what our standards are, know that the law is on our side, and start feeling empowered and not ashamed or embarrassed to draw those distinctions in every time a situation comes up of encroachment or anything else.
How would these standards be put into practice in terms of mosques, in terms of Islamic schools? How would you put these standards into official practice?
Okay, so in other words, give us some specific examples?
With regard to immigration, I completely agree that there needs to be an articulation in immigration papers or an application for green card or citizenship where someone specifically denounces on the one hand, and you can put it broadly, it doesn't even have to use the word jihad. You can say any ideology that violates or seeks to be more important than the U.S. Constitution, our doctrines of separation of church and state, our definition of universal human rights. You can say in a broad way where you are putting anyone on the spot that's coming in the next. But on the second hand...
But how do we know that they'll do that once they sign it and get it?
Okay, on the one hand, the majority of Muslims are not doing anything against you. It is the small specific population, which unfortunately, yes, has a disproportionate number of influencing moms. So that has to do with the books that they are putting in their Islamic schools. That has to do with reviewing imams and what kind of qualifications they have to come and lead a church. If we need to change the language in a religious visa that shows some kind of license or some kind of test that they have to take, that do you agree with any kind of principle that, again, defends secularism and democracy, they should be allowed in. But you cannot do anything about people until they, as is with the law, say or do anything that rises to the level of incitement. Otherwise, you will always be labeled a bigot and a racist.
I'm not worried about being labeled as a bigot or a racist. I'm concerned about I don't care about what liberals think are as bigoted and racist. But they regard any defense of our society as bigoted and racist. In England, if people the Union Jack is now called racist because it represents Britain, and Britain is a historically white country, therefore it's racist. So I don't accept these terms.
So to that point, did you understand or agree with what I was saying? I'm not talking about the UK. If they right now are going through the problems that they're going through because somehow they have some misconstrued embarrassment of their historical role in, you know, imperial history with regard to colonized countries, that they no longer understand what it is to be British or proud to be British, that is part of their understanding of liberalism, that's the problem.
And once they become proud of being British, what would they then do?
They would then, hopefully, which is the whole point of me going back to secularism, understanding that there is one umbrella identity, which is citizenship, that is supposed to be the governing marker for all other communities, which, if they understood that that's what it is, you cannot then have parallel societies that allow for Sharia.
How would they stop those parallel societies?
They would not allow Sharia courts to make them legal, number one.
But why should any country allow in people that are such a problem to them?
Allow anyone to just come in?
Why should they allow immigrants who are representing this huge problem? They say, okay, we'll let these people in, and then we'll work on them for 50 years, and maybe it'll work out somehow.
But that's not what you're saying.
That's not what you're saying.
No, that's something in your own world, because, again, I don't live in
the
majority of the problem. I believe rather the minority are, and it's about...
But the minority are the leaders. A community is defined by what its leadership does. The others don't have the power. The leaders have the power. What you're saying reminds me of the movie made by Gaffney and two others, I forget their names.
Islam and Islamism.
Right. I saw that movie the night it was shown in New York 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And let me just take a minute to describe it to you very quickly. The movie itself showed moderate Muslims as powerless individuals in Islamic communities that hated them. The people in charge were these Sharia jihad imams speaking with tremendous confidence about how they were going to take over the West. And the moderates in the movie, who were the heroes of the movie, were basically powerless victims and martyrs. That was the movie itself. Then the movie came to an end, and there was a discussion period. And one of the moderate Muslims who was featured in the movie, I'm sorry, I forget his name, he came on and said, well, he said, he sounded just like you. He said, most Muslims in America, they're just secular guys like me, and we're just part of America, and we're the real Muslims. And I stood up and I said, wait a second, there's a total disconnect between what the movie is saying and what you're saying the movie is saying. The movie is saying that the jihadists are the power that are in control of Islam. Well, you're turning around and saying, no, they're not the real Muslims. They're not anything to worry about. It's us secularized, relaxed American guys. We're the real Muslims. So the same thing is happening in your discussion. You keep talking about how powerful, how they control the mosques. They do this. There's no institutionalized forms of modern Islam. We have to somehow create them. You're recognizing all the power that the jihadist type of Islam has. And then it's like you forget it all. You say, yes, but I believe in something else. And somehow this nice type of Islam is what we ought to see as the real Islam. So you are, the practical effect of your message is to make people forget the very danger that you have actually admitted exists.
I actually never touched upon what I want other people to see. That was a completely new tangent. But to retort to your comment, there are things that you can do that are two-pronged. I guess that's the right way to say it. With the project like I work at, for example, Islamist Watch, the Middle East Forum, all we do all day long is try to identify that Islamist. So when you know an organization is Islamist, you already now have the power to question everything they do, everything they write, every activity they have. You have power to talk to your congressman. You have power to not vote for a president or anybody else that's aligned with Islamists, on the one hand. So we do have the power to marginalize these groups by calling them out. On the other
hand, why admit groups that we have to marginalize?
Sorry?
Why should we admit groups into a country that we then have to marginalize?
We should admit them. People in Muslim Brotherhood or CARE or ISNA or Jamaat Islami, you should not allow them in. I'm absolutely for that. But the whole point I'm trying to make is you don't know who someone is until they say or do something. That's just a fact. And I understand why you're saying it is so much easier than to just turn the knob on immigration and all of them. I completely understand. But what I'm trying to say is it's not going to ever happen. So then what you have to have a policy and an interpretation and a strategy that will, whether it's short-term or long-term, or hopefully both have a short-term strategy and a long-term one, to engage with the problem, that is something you can actually sell to politicians and the public. And I know what you're saying. I respect what you're saying. Believe me or not, I do respect what you're saying, because I know with Americans, if you don't know Muslims or Islam and all you ever saw was 9/11, you have no reason to believe in anything else besides what you saw that day in the news after that. But the United States Congress is just never going to pass a law that broad. So how do you deal with it in a real functional way? Then at least call the Islamists Islamists. Talk about how it is part of the faith. And if Muslims don't want it to be part of the faith, that they have to start pushing, like engage it. If you put them in a position where they are forced to say, oh, I'm Muslim or an Islamist, you're forcing them to make a decision. But if you just say Islam is bad or Muslims are bad, what you get is that uber liberal response, where it's like, oh my God, you're this or that, and then they just continue to do that, which is most Muslims that I talk to. They don't want to talk about Islam as a political movement that they should denounce.
Well, that isn't very encouraging.
Excuse me. I want to clarify something, because I think you two agree on a lot of things. I think maybe it hasn't been expressed sufficiently. What I'm hearing you, Sufna, what I'm hearing you say, but not loudly enough, mm-hmm. is the onus is not on changing the Muslims. The onus is on our Western world to shape itself up and remind itself of its values and have the guts to defend its values in every field and in every way.
And if the West believed in itself and had the kind of confidence in itself that you say it ought to have, would it have admitted the Muslim mass immigration in the first place?
I'm starting today. I'm hearing what she's saying, and I'm trying to check whether I'm hearing correctly.
Yes, absolutely. For example, you have the Dutch cartoons that made the big brouhaha. Yeah. Even if I was offended, even if it's a smidge, it absolutely has the right to be printed and replicated 1,000 times, because that's freedom of speech.
Right.
Catholics are funded every day by some art gallery exhibit of Jesus and God knows what position.
They don't riot.
They don't riot. They don't kill people. They can maybe write a letter, or they have their own community conversation about something that offends them. But no one, at least no Catholic, is doing anything that amounts to any kind of violence that Muslims had a hissy fit over in Pakistan over those cartoons. Yet they don't flinch when there's honor killing. They don't flinch when there's an actual harm done to a community member. Put it back on them. Say, what is your problem?
We do.
And what was it in front of them?
And where are your leaders saying, I condemn this behavior, or this honor killing, or this rape? No one does it. They're afraid.
But not even that. But when it comes to free speech and stuff, when publishers don't want to publish something, or newspapers don't want to, publish it. Do it more. I sometimes feel like...
Or they're afraid. They're afraid.
She's not talking about
Muslims. They get killed.
She's not talking about Americans.
They're afraid. Americans are afraid. Okay. Yes. Because they kill.
But not even that. When you have...
That's the problem.
When you have...
They sue and they kill. And they make life miserable for people.
That's the problem. The publisher of the book about Aisha did not publish the book because he was afraid his stores would be burnt, his books would be taken and desecrated, and that all around the world, every time that publisher's name came up, there would be a riot. So he didn't publish the book. That is an estoppel of our freedom of expression, freedom of speech.
And that was his choice, though, to retreat.
Right.
And
but he shouldn't have done it.
That's right. Shouldn't have. But there was an individual choice to retreat and appease.
But who's the enemy? That's the question. Who is the enemy?
Well, sometimes
Larry is saying, who's the enemy? Who is the enemy? You don't have an enemy? There's no enemy? Who are we up against? Who's the foe here?
Any Muslim wants to talk about their faith in any way that's not personal. Anyone who believes in political Islam is the enemy.
Well, how many Muslims is that? What percentage of Muslims would that be?
10%.
Honestly, powerful minority.
10%, which is more than enough to make life miserable.
No, honestly, it could even be 8%, but the problem is you have Saudi Arabia behind them. You have countries that have billions of dollars of oil money behind them. Mm-hmm. What I would do if I could do a law, honestly, I would stop all foreign funding of mosques and Islamic schools. Yeah. If you want a mosque, it should be a grassroots effort. Right. Because then I know it's local. And then I know it's not politicized. Right. And that's why I went to a mosque that wasn't politicized. Because it was a rented church on Saturday. Or it was, you know, some local, whatever random building in a room. We weren't getting money from Iran or Saudi Arabia.
I teach college, and I went to the MSA, the Muslim
Student
Association.
They get money from,
and they get out. I was sitting there terrified in that meeting. I was taking notes, and people surrounded me. Muslim boys surrounded me, watching me write. What are you writing? And everybody was listening because they were giving food at the end of this thing, and everybody was waiting for the food. And they were bringing in imams, and everybody was wearing, you know, the whole Muslim dress. And it was terrifying in our secular city to see this whole panoply arrayed against innocent college kids, because they were mostly
They're not innocent. They're old enough to know better.
Jewish organizations say, "Come to the group. We'll have Hillel. We'll have cookies on Purim or something."
Right.
But nobody does this full panoply press of giving you a chapter and verse. Boys asked in the audience, "Well, what about all the killings? What about this SGM and so forth?" And they said, "Oh, that isn't done anymore," which is a lie.
Right.
It is a lie, and it was consistent. Every MSA meeting was
the MSA, for example, is another tangible target. If people increasingly wrote against MSA and labeled it a political organization, not a religious club, maybe that would start the conversation about how it's connected to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
If you are a religious club, you should be talking about praying and fasting and charity. You shouldn't be talking about anti-Israel rallies 24/7 and whatever the talk about.
Let me make a statement, okay? I think that you two are agreeing on a lot, and what I'm hearing is that political Islam is our enemy, if that makes you, Jamie, you were talking, what's the enemy? And I think
MSA is the enemy.
Political Islam, in all of its manifestations, and what we can do about it is become sure of our right to fight it, to stand up for what we believe in. And one of the things that has formed us to the things, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and all the founding papers. So what I am proposing for this act chapter is that we start study groups to reacquaint ourselves with our founding documents, to build up our strength for what could be a very long fight to push back political action by political action against political Islam. Is anybody interested? If you are,
I got a more proactive stance. I think we need to get on the college campuses, get the MSA right in the face with Act for America location on campus. You want to put in Christian Action Network or any, or even her?
You can do that too.
It has to be on the campus.
Do it.
You cannot do this in the back room,
bunch
of 51 people. We're preaching to the choir. We've got to be on the campuses.
Do it.
We are doing it. We're doing our ruckus right now.
When something just asked, was saying that when people come in, it's a very reasonable thing to ask questions, such as you said, do you believe that there is any law that is superseded the American Constitution?
So let me ask and sit here and stand. This is what we believe. Or if you sign this, you are saying
and Larry's position was that they signed it. He was going to stop them from doing anything. But one of the things that we do know is that the Muslims very rarely, unless I'm misunderstanding, I mean, you will, They're not going to say, they're not going to say, yes, I will sign something with the American Constitution as the highest standard. An Islamist is...
It would be good. It would
he
be...
won't sign it.
But
that's not true. They can lie.
And, I don't think they are.
We all know that.
Let's talk about Robert Spencer for a second. Yeah. Quick, tell us in 1 minute. It's very instructive. For years, and I was always criticizing Spencer because I felt you're complaining about criticizing Islam, but never talking about immigration and other things. But his position was that immigration process should screen out any jihad believers. This was his position for quite a while. I was criticizing him. I said, it's not adequate. Then, 2 years ago, he changed his position and he 180 degrees and said, screening will not work because there is no way that we have any human ability to really determine where a person is coming from, what his beliefs, associations, and future actions and beliefs and associations will be. And that was when he switched and began to say we have to stop Muslim immigration.
Uh-huh. But according to a book that I saw this morning, and that was on C-SPAN, the rules after 9/11 changed radically so that all Muslim majoritarian countries had a vastly squeezed limit of people permitted to come into this country. However, the author said every other country like England, France, Germany also had Muslims, so people didn't need visas or problems from those countries. And those people came in from those countries, which are now major.
Not only that, after a couple of years, the immigration from the Muslim countries was opened up again.
Just from the years of there was an immigration lawyer, there is absolute reality check that people have to understand that you don't know what someone's thinking between their heads. So if they really do think something nefarious or negative, it just depends how smart they are. If they're dumb, they're going to sign anything. But as a short-term versus a long-term thing, again, if you at least had that as a start in terms of an oath, then what you could do in terms of the way the INS laws are broken down, you could have immediate effect. If someone, for example, was, you know, not only defending jihad or anti-American conversations, but let's say Hal's pro-polygamy, like DVDs or things that they... Because they use that polygamy as an example of something tangible that becomes part of the anti-American argument. If they signed an oath, for example, and said, you know, I agree with all these liberal, you know, American principles, and then they're caught doing something that violates one of those principles, it should be immediately deportable. So that you don't have to deal with long-winded appeals processes through immigration, that you're still here for 3 years, and then, hey, it overlaps with an amnesty, and then you're converted over. So there has to be ways that it could be articulated.
That might be enough to disclose.
It limits it. I mean, it's not everything. And then
it certainly would be a step in the right direction, but I don't think it's adequate.
Yeah.
And Obama does not help. Obama.
I think the picture is somewhat discouraging regarding what you say. For example, in some of these Midwestern colleges, the girls come in completely head to toe. You would have thought right away America, they wouldn't do that. No. And that actually is protected by our freedom of religion. We never thought that would be, but it is. Then, washing of the feet. They disrupted all the bathrooms. You would have thought that would have been something to stop them. They disrupted them, made them unusable by others. You would have thought the college president would say, let's talk to these Muslim students. Let's talk to the local imam. What can we say to them that they don't? No, he in fact asked them, and they said, we'll give us foot baths. You would have thought that the fact that these are tax-supported colleges, sorry, we can't give you foot baths.
And that's where you have
that. And then, no, they put them in. Then you would have thought the ACLU would come in. No, the ACLU said the foot baths are okay because they're hygiene. They're not religion. So the ACLU is not going to do anything on that. So you see one thing after another,
and that's the capitulation. Right argument right back at them using the law and the Constitution. That's my whole point. For example, with regard to modesty, I have a problem with the headscarf, but a niqab and a burqa actually violate ID and security issues, and they do not have anything to do with modesty. You don't need to be Muslim to use your common sense of what is modesty.
I know, but what I'm saying is none of the local imams are saying, you know, you don't need to dress that way to go to college. You don't need to wash your feet in that fashion. They're not saying that. They're encouraging these very intrusive practices. The young Muslims themselves are all for it.
That's why you shouldn't rely on them. and for the immediate...
Are they, not that I ask you objectively,
yeah,
I understand more how you said during your talk that you make the distinction between Islamists and Muslims.
Yeah.
As a way of creating a psychological divide,
yeah,
between the two parts of the
Jews,
community.
Yeah.
But in reality, okay, so I understand that you're trying to, it's a kind of a tactical divide.
I mean, I believe it, but it's tactical.
But are you saying in reality that Sharia believing, jihad believing, Muslim clerics, all the rest of it, mm-hmm. are not Muslims?
No, because they believe what they believe based on their real interpretation.
Are they Muslims?
To themselves, yeah.
Are they objectively Muslims?
Yeah.
Okay, then why in all of your articles do you call them Islamists?
Because they're also Islamists. All Islamists are Muslim, all Muslims are not Islamists.
It still creates the impression that people who are following traditional Sharia Islam are not real Muslims.
But when you say traditional,
and that has the effect, yeah, that has the this very confusing effect on the reader. A reading
the
this,
have to grow
somebody
up.
Picks up an article by Sukhna Zaidi and says, well, Sukhna Zaidi is very opposed to Sharia. Okay, that's good. And then she says the people that believe in Sharia are not Muslims. They're this other thing called Islamists. So you confuse people very much. And the net effect of it all is to make people believe that Islam itself is not a problem. Only Islamism is a problem.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think that has a very, that the overall effect of that is to weaken a society's ability to defend itself from the dangerous form of Islam.
No problem writing another article clarifying that. If you can't be satisfied with what you do at home for your faith, then I have a problem with you.
But all religions are, you see, that's another
thing. That's a secularized version of all faith. Judaism has a legalistic code, but today is much more based on piety and ethics. That's why you have the difference between orthodoxy
and it doesn't impose itself.
Exactly.
No, but real religions are not just private. You know, if you...
Well, then you have the Bible and the Constitution, what's your point there?
No, for example, Reform Judaism
is
virtually not Judaism. Either traditional Judaism, traditional Orthodox Judaism, or modern Orthodox Judaism, and maybe some forms of conservatism. But when you get to the real secularized forms of Judaism, likewise, you can't. That's not a real religion. The same thing. Messiah is teaching sort of a non-religion and saying that's the real, that's
well,
the real Islam.
I don't think that's true.
The real Islam, by its very nature, is public, social, political.
Right.
It's not just private. She's trying to create something that has never existed except in individual private realm and trying to act as though this can become the common Islamic belief and practice for most or all Muslims. And it's a fantasy. Should we gamble the future of our society on this wild hope, this wishful thinking? I don't think so.
And extending from what you said, I feel, having been to Malaysia and Indonesia and Pakistan and India and all these countries and having lived over there, I believe that they're on the juggernaut. The juggernaut is we are now kicking ass, as you said before, because people are now retracting and retreating frightfully with fear. And that very concept that they are now on the ascendant, whereas before, for 300 years they were quiescent, that makes the problem in and of itself, because they will not sit back.
But to catch you off, if there was only one Islam, or someone would be fighting in India right now. And that's what you guys forget.
I lived in Malaysia where the people were wearing jeans and a terrific...
What did Khomeini do? I mean, before Khomeini, you had the Shah, you had a Persian empire that was Muslim. Well, Khomeini was the first one in the 1970s to write an entire treatise on his version of Shiaism that made him the Ayatollah, that created the Guardian Council, that institutionalized Sharia. So you can have this vague belief, all which maybe all Muslims do, that we want to live under Sharia, but it's intangible. It means nothing. It illustrates itself in different ways depending on the generation or the century. Politicized Islam since the 1900s was the first time that they are sitting down, codifying it in a way where there is no, you know, this version of bad Islam versus that version of some lesser degree good or bad Islam. But it's becoming a monolithic thing now that it is becoming the only Islam.
But Robert Spencer would completely disagree with you. He would say the four schools of Islamic law,
there are more than
jurisprudence,
schools, though, before the Jews.
They are the ones that have the authority, that have the followership, that people follow,
mm-hmm.
and they differ on details,
mm-hmm.
but the fundamentals of Sharia are the same among the four Sunni schools of jurisprudence and in Shiite Islam.
But if you read Hadith,
so this again, it's a very typical kind of liberal argument to say, well, there's a problem over here. There's some entity we're concerned with that some people feel is a concern. But the liberals come on saying, oh no, it's not really monolithic. You see, there's a lot of diversity within this entity, so you don't need to worry about it so much. Liberals are always doing this to distract people's attention from the essence of that entity itself. For example, communism. So, well, all right, there were conflicts, tensions between communist China and the Soviet Union. There was a war between communist China and Vietnam. There was a war between Vietnam and Cambodia. Does that mean that communism was not communism? So there are all kinds of conflicts within Islam. Does that mean that Islam is not Islam? I don't think so.
Well, I don't know what that means, but there are conflicts with Islam,
Well, even the Iranian Revolution, not everybody thought it. Even in the Iranian Revolution, not everybody thought it was going to be wind up like this. They were, that's all they were.
But that's kind of like my whole point when you talk about there's a variety of Islam, but not. It's like in Pakistan right now, and obviously I know more about that because that's where my family is from. Is you have this internal struggle about different, you know, minority Muslim groups, non-Muslim groups. Women's rights organizations that have been trying to repeal the sort of small aspect of Sharia that have been codified in Pakistan, that there are millions of Muslims in Pakistan, whether they're educated or not educated, that don't want the Taliban, that don't want the Jamaat Islamist Party, which is to come into power. The JI, the Islamist Party, they've never gotten the majority of votes for a reason. But now, with like President Obama, you know, further engaging Islamists, just legitimizing the Muslim Brotherhood, the JI is going to get more money now from abroad, and it is a fight.
Now, I fully understand what you're saying. It seems like you're kind of making or recognizing that dichotomy between spiritual and ritualistic aspects and the politics. But I'm just wondering what your belief is about, you know, Muhammad himself and in his writings. I realize you said before that you can't know since it was in a pretty much distinct language, but what do you think the original intention was of the Quran?
Yeah, that's
intent. I mean, was there that separation between the politics and the personal one?
That's the thing. Like, I focus on, like, the five pillars, for example. Those are the daily rituals and that have a personal meaning to me. The history of Islam itself or the Prophet himself, that is a life and history that has no commonality with me today because that was, you know, 7th century Arabia where I'm 21st century America. So I can say however the nature of the Prophet was, it was typical of Arab Bedouin culture for that century. Unfortunately, Arab Bedouin culture, I don't think, has changed that much, and they subsist on very substandard, you know, understandings of universal human rights, this, that, and the other. But if I wanted to be very liberal and very hopeful, I could make the argument which many liberal progressive Muslims try to do is, look, when the Prophet and Islam came about, for example, with regard to women, women were property. They were complete child, they had no property rights, they had no rights with regard to family or custody or whatever. So at that time, the laws that Islam propagated with regard to women were actually liberal. It gave women, you know, a certain degree. Number one, it said they weren't property. Second, it gave them, I think, evidentiary laws or a half to a man. And it gave them certain inheritance rights, whatever, right? But it did something. So for that century, it improved the status of women. Now, in a very pragmatic, secular sense, if I can say whatever those improvements were just based on his negotiating skills with the other tribes of the region, and that's the best he could do. Did he want more for women or less or whatever? I don't know. That's an open question for historians and archaeologists. But what I can say today for Muslims today is you have an absolute problem if you want a living faith that has any relevance in modern society, if you stick to the literalist interpretation of your religion, rather than seek any good intent behind anything that was done. So if a woman was property and it no longer was after Islam, don't you want to focus that and now focus on today what our standards of human rights are? And great, and that's something, it is completely theoretical what I'm talking about. This is an academic answer.
Okay.
It has, and there's very few people, like in Malaysia, there's an organization called Sisters of Islam that do their reform work in the Muslim, and they have affected Malaysian laws, but they're the only organization I know about.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
A couple of things. I want to sort of relate Carol Iannone's point and Misaki's point. This Iannone, what Carol was saying, that, well, it doesn't matter what Sufna is saying, we're not going to be able to do this. People are actually afraid. There is an intimidation that it works both on Muslims and on non-Muslims. Mm-hmm. While Sufna is saying that, well, we can work on it, we can persuade, we can build something different. You look at those two positions together, and we realize the problem is that as long as Muslims are among us, large numbers and in force, the tendency is going to be, as Carol says, that the society is going to be intimidated by the Muslims, is going to accommodate them, is not going to want to fight, because in America, we don't believe in discriminating against the minority. We believe in giving the minority what it wants. It's considered racist and bigoted not to give the minority what it wants. So as the Muslims make more and more demands, the general trend of Western society is to yield to them. And this leads us to something which I have not discussed in the talk, although Madeline mentioned it in her introduction to me. My overall policy is called separationism. I think ultimately the only way to save the West, its historic culture and freedom from Islam, is the separation of Islam from the West. Because as long as Muslims are among us in significant numbers, the inevitable dynamic takes place in which their Sharia-commanded aggressiveness and Westerners, you know, uncertainty is going to result in them gaining more and more power and our yielding more and more to them. The only way to solve the problem is through having a fence between the Muslim world and the rest of the world. It doesn't mean that all people have to be removed, but the whole movement of Islam moving into the West must be stopped and to a significant degree reversed. I think that's the only solution.
Larry, can I respond to that?
Yes.
I can, you know, on a certain emotional level, I can really appreciate that. It's sort of like Israel putting up a wall against Arabs who want to kill them. However, I have some questions about its practicality. How would such a bill get passed in a political climate such as we have now?
It couldn't pass in the political climate we have now.
Even if you were to deport every objection, let's say all Muslims, except maybe Sufna, you would still, we're still, because we live in a world that's so internationalized, so globalized, we would still face problems coming, you know, into ballistic missiles.
That's another issue.
Electrical grid, stuff like that. So it looks like an easy solution, but
I did not say it's easy at all. I said I'm pointing to a general direction. Obviously, it's not something that can be done now. There would have to be a sea change in the thinking and value system of the West. That's what I am arguing for.
How would you respond to someone if they might say, I don't know if this is relevant, but if they might say to you, well, they're creating their own separatism already because they have their societies in France and in Paris and in England where they don't want to mix with the Western culture.
Well, there are two sides to that. Yes, there are a lot of areas in Europe now, in neighborhoods and cities and so on. They're completely Islamic controlled, and white Europeans go into those areas, and it's truly a foreign area. But that's not. And that would be, bad enough. That would be a future scenario.
So that justifies
the
possibility.
We could have a future scenario. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, your point policy to not let them in the first place if that's what they're doing, because if you want a parallel society, then your own society, why do you need a parallel
right,
one? Because
right.
the only reason to have a parallel one is to take the benefits of disability here, but then otherwise just reinvent your own home.
Right. What you have is the typical paradigm of multiculturalism, which is that you have the mainstream society, and then you have all the separate ethnic societies. And the way it works is, in every institution, in every field, the mainstream society or institution must be diverse, must be welcoming to minorities, must be numerically proportional based on everybody's group. While the ethnic-specific side organizations are purely for that organization. So you have, say, police. The police must be, you know, they're constantly seeking racial diversity and so on within the police. But then you also have Hispanic police, brotherhoods, black police organizations. It's the same in journalism and so on. You don't have a white journalist society. You don't have a white policeman's organization. So you basically have, this is basically a response to your point, that yes, there are the separate ethnic exclusive communities, organizations, institutions, but at the same time, they are also exerting their influence in the mainstream society
as well.
They're getting it both ways. It's not as though they're just being held off in ghettos or something. That's my point.
Yeah.
And it's also that even these separate neighborhoods, it's not as though there are people there and they're just content with those types of neighborhoods.
Yes.
What they would like very much is to include them here, so
they yeah, that's the problem.
I read a draft, actually I was editing it for the fellow named Sam Song, who was working on an article, and I can tell you some ideas about it. It's one of those powerful things that I've read. I hope he finishes it. He's a former Muslim. He spells out step by step how Sharia progresses, how it starts. And it's from the moment an immigrant community arrives, they first, I can't replicate it all now, but everything they do step by step is to gaining and spreading the power of Sharia. I hope he finishes it.
I have an idea. Maybe this would sort of begin to wrap things up because it's getting late. You two have disagreed on some things. You've also agreed on a number of things. And I wonder if you could...
That's been a very useful discussion.
Yeah. I wonder if you could, some other points, write down your articles of agreement, all right? You also have the sidebar where you disagree. That could be a very interesting paper and maybe even a way that we could begin to focus our efforts on what we as citizens do and encourage our politicians to do to make some real changes and to protect us from the people who want to hurt us. Would you both be willing to do that?
Great.
Can we wind up now?